Hello, and welcome to the Indie Beginning Podcast. It is our mission to bring indie authors and readers together. Each month, we feature two independently published stories and follow each story with a discussion episode where we discuss a unique topic with the author and reviews and questions that you, the listener and book lover, have submitted. This week, we are featuring J.G. Follinsby's dystopian tale, Carbon Run, set in a future devastated by global warming. Right from the start, the reader discovers that this read is more than just a look at our current practices, but also a smart vision of how our children's children may cope with the outcome of those practices. After the episode, remember to send us your questions or comments. Head over to acnbooks.com/indie-beginning-podcast. Don't worry, there's a link in the show notes. And let us know what you thought and what you would like to know more about. You can also find all of our past stories and discussions there as well. The information our featured authors have provided have helped many authors just starting their writing career. Remember to subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast platform to keep up to date with future episodes. And now, allow Indie Beginning to introduce you to J.G. Follinsby's Carbon Run. Carbon Run by J.G. Follinsby. Chapter 1. Some poor devil down valley's gonna have a carbon ticket in their comm if they don't douse that fire now. And Penn dismissed the thought before turning back to the male Klamath Magpie. Pushing hair the color of fresh-sawn pine from her oval face, she was so intent on the bird she was observing from her blind that she didn't notice the disappearance of the sun as charcoal clouds skulked east. The bird grasped the carcass of a dead tree with its needle-like talons, the yellow band on its left leg visible. He belted out a screep, 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 and hoped a female answered. If it didn't, the subspecies was doomed to extinction, another victim of the warming. "Ann, what do you want for supper?" The comm message from Ann's father blinked in her visual field. She clicked her tongue impatiently. "Wait a minute, Dad." He always managed to break her focus at the wrong time. Something's happening. Can't wait long, my dear. Another rumble rolled down the valley toward their ranch half a mile away. Anne crouched in the wildlife refuge where she had watched a colony of magpies since her 14th summer. For 5 years, she had worked as a volunteer observer, following the instructions of government scientists. That first summer, the ornithologist called her Swifty, a comment on her keen, if immature, mind, which bounced from subject to subject, turning on a dime like the swifts he studied. Last summer, one of the young biologists, a cute, bookish boy, claimed her elegant, streamlined shape compared well with the swifts. The awkward compliment made her laugh. She thought the word lanky was enough of a description. Her mind was more disciplined now. The male bird called again, and Anne heard a whoosh overhead as a drab female Klamath magpie swooped onto the nub of a broken branch. The male called again, showing his blood-red throat patch. The ladybird lingered. The male spread his wings in an invitation. They tussled. Anne was elated at the mating. The population of Klamath magpies, the last known on Earth, just might make it through another year. She yawned, tired from a long day, and she grew hungry in anticipation of her father's basic, delicious cooking. "Coming home, Dad. I broke out a jar of my pasta sauce. Pasta's boiling on the hot plate." Bill Penn made gallons of Anne's favorite Italian sauce from the tomatoes he didn't sell at the farmer's market, but the smell of smoke drowned out her anticipation. Two fixed-wing aircraft roared overhead up the valley. Anne called up her Briar Valley news chan, and she found live images of a forest fire 10 kilometers upwind under attack by the tankers. The images broke up in her mind's eye display. "Anne, I've got a problem." Her father's message broke into her mind's eye. "Anne, are you there? He never uses that voice unless something's wrong. Anne, answer me." "Switch to voice," Anne commanded the comm stud in her ear. "I'm here, Dad. What's wrong?" "Call 911. I've got a fire in the kitchen. The extinguisher is exhausted." His voice was calm, if clipped. "Did you say fire?" "I'm rigging up a hose. I need you here." He spoke in his sailor's voice, the one he used to give orders, the one that gave others confidence. "What about Maxie? Where is she?" "I don't know where the dog is. Get down here now, please." She scrambled across an old stream bed and ducked under a fence, Despite his even tone, she heard impatience, and it magnified her anxiety. Her house was 100 yards away, and a thin plume of black smoke rose from behind it. She'd lived there all her life. Everything she owned was there. The woodcut. Please, God, no. Anne remembered her father's orders and directed her attention to the comm. Emergency call numbers. Call 911. McCall County Emergency Services. Can we help you? I can handle this. My house is on fire. It's in the kitchen. A tremble in her voice betrayed her fear. The emergency dispatcher confirmed Anne's coordinates sent to the dispatcher when Anne made the 911 call. The Penn Ranch. William Penn? Yes, that's right. Please hurry.
Fire units are on their way, ma'am.
Anne ran to the far side of the house. Her father was spraying water from a garden hose into the kitchen through an open window. An electric pump labored, drawing water from an aluminum horse trough, but the stream was weak. That will never put out the fire. Sparks curled up over the eave and landed on the roof. Anne felt useless as the water hissed off the shingles. If I could save the woodcut, I don't care if the whole place goes up. She approached the kitchen steps, putting her hand up to block the heat. Stay away from the kitchen, Anne's father bellowed. Damn this piece of shit pump. I'm going to go start the gasoline pump. The thought of rescuing her father's precious gift vanished. No, Dad, you can't do that. The cops, to hell with them. I'll do whatever I have to do. Bill Penn headed towards the shed where they hid the obsolete engine. His intricate tattoos shone through his water-soaked t-shirt. In the shade of the outbuilding, Maxie whined. The ranch's old basset hound was frightened, but unhurt. No, Dad, you can't risk it. What if the cops show up? You know what the judge said. Screw the judge. This is all I have, he pointed to the burning house. It's all we have. Fear for her gift returned. Even as the flames licked the wall of her homes and threatened everything else she owned, her father found the woodcut in an antique shop in Port Simpson, a year after they stopped hearing from her mother. It was a page in a book of poems published in the 1820s, frayed, yellowed, but preserved under the glass. The print showed a vigorous English sailor and a girl child of 4 or 5 reaching out to embrace one another. To Anne's eyes, the sailor looked exactly like her father. Pleasant face, strong arms, rough around the edges. The gift marked the moment her anger towards her mother began to fade. For 15 years, the artwork hung in the kitchen, above the table where father and daughter ate their meals. More than 200 years ago, an artist had captured the love and respect for each other. The thought of losing the image tore at Anne. Bill knocked down the tongues of flame, but 2 sprang up in their places. Convection currents carried embers over the roof and out of sight. Soot stung Anne's eyes like tiny insects until it obscured the mind's eye display of her comm. Messages came in from her loop as friends picked up her emo sigs of distress, but the smoke made her eyes tear up. And when she wiped the tears away, her hand distorted the shape of her eye and the display went fuzzy. Dirty sweat trickled down her neck, along a gold chain with almost microscopic links that held the thumbnail-sized crucifix next to her skin. Her control over her fear slipped as it mixed with the stink of burning insulation and decayed tar paper. She heard her father's voice, but couldn't see him.
Anne, where are you? Her father screamed through the surging blackness. Call 911 again! The fire's spreading!
Anne updated the dispatcher, but it would take 10 more minutes for the trucks to arrive. Because the Penn place was so far up the valley, her rising terror emerged as frustration when he repeated his plan to use the gas pump. She grabbed the dribbling hose.
You're always breaking the rules. Is that why the fire started?
The accusation brought her father up short.
What are you talking about? I need your help, not a lecture. Help me with this pump.
I'm sorry, Daddy. I'm scared.
She rushed to the back of the building. Guilt and the thought of rescuing the woodcut along with a few belongings driving her. A window shattered from the intense heat, discouraging her. She called out to her father again, but he didn't answer. She wished he would get one of the new augmenters. Adding him to her sea tribe would get her better sense of what he was thinking and feeling, even when there wasn't an emergency.
Dad, I'm in the back.
Most people over 30 didn't get the concept of sea tribes anyways.
Like her dad, they were still using old-fashioned slow jack-ins. They might as well be using cell phones.
Her father came out to the back porch and Anne pointed to the sky.
There's smoke coming up from the roof, Daddy. Get some water on it. Fear pitched his voice high as he handed her the garden hose. For the first time in her life, she saw raw horror in his face. It was the opposite of what Anne knew. There was the time Maxie confronted a rattlesnake when she was a puppy. The snake coiled to strike, but Bill just crushed it with a shovel. He was always calm in a crisis, but this one was getting away from him, and it frightened Anne. He coughed as he held a cloth over his mouth. I'm going to move the truck. We can't lose it. The decision bolstered Anne's confidence. If I could just get inside the house for 30 seconds. Mentally, she listed hollow pics of dead ancestors, trophies, and ribbons from her school. Her prom dress, the signed t-shirt from the Hindu Mistress concert, the only time she'd ever seen a live music performance by a pop band. Bill had taken her. A bark from Maxie brought Anne back to her job. Get water on the roof. Mist from the nozzle soaked her denim overalls. Water dripped on the rockery by the front porch and boiled away. On the roof, flames danced among the shingles. Anne heard the whine of the old truck's electric motor pitch up and the chirr, chirr of the gears as her father tried to find reverse. They couldn't afford to take it to the repair shop. Despite their poverty, he had bought her mind's eye for Christmas as she had begged for months. Everyone in Briar Valley owned one. Everyone she knew, at least. Helpless, as she and her father waited for the firefighters, Anne's thoughts flashed to the birthday. She went with her best friends to the mall in Medford and the comm company booth with its gift certificate in hand. She was not one to buy gaudy electronics, and she picked out a head appliance styled like an ordinary silver stud, if larger than average. She had it installed at the top of her left ear, which was the fashion at Briar High. She had to settle for one without the imager, because of the cost, so she wouldn't be able to share stills and vids. It would take her months to save for the imager add-on. The sales tech turned the appliance to the wave frequencies of her optical lobe and limbic system. She squealed with delight as she looped herself into her friends' tribes and created her own tribe. Her digital memories were safe with the comm company, but when a corner of the porch collapsed, she despaired for her other memories, the ones she could hold in her hand. They're all gone. Pieces of her life were slipping through her fingers. Bill managed to get the truck moving, even as the fire's heat blistered the paint off the hood. A gust of wind lifted an ember, and it floated like a feather in the breeze. The wind carried it to the woodland next to the ranch. As if she had second sight, Anne saw the future. Oh, God! The refuge! The wisp of fire landed in a tinder dry brush and flared. Her fear turned into panic, but not for her home. Her matted hair flying, Anne ran past the lurching truck, carrying a tin bucket. Bill yelled as she flew by. The house no longer mattered. She dipped the bucket into the half-empty horse trough and splashed the water onto the blackening grass. It wasn't enough. Within seconds, the offspring of the house fire raged into the pines. The fire jumped from tree to tree like a mad demon. Anne made another 911 call. Where are you? Are you coming? Please hurry! As if in answer to her prayer, a fixed-wing aircraft arrived first. Anne heard the drone before she saw it. It's about time. Several of the big tankers were always somewhere over the Cascade Mountains, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week during the dry season. Their pilots waited for orders at workstations in the Western States Fire Suppression Center. Anne had taken a tour of it for her junior year environmental defense class. The tour guide said most of the pilots were veterans of the 3 degrees North War. Anne ducked by instinct as the initial sorties dive-bombed the forest around the refuge at tree level. It was now a war against destruction. She prayed for every strike. Experienced pilots were as precise as raptors. They could hit a single tree with their water payloads, leaving the tree's neighbors dry as a bone. She leapt for joy at each hit. She messaged her sea tribe in jubilation, and the hurrahs and yays came back within seconds. Thousands of gallons of fire retardant and water carpeted the blaze. But the flames defied the aircraft like rioters. More sorties attacked the fiery stragglers. Messages appeared in her mind's eye, warned her to stay clear, but she thought she saw the magpie nest with the newly mated pair, unharmed. Stay in the nest. You'll be fine. The sun glinted off the silver wings as the plane banked to avoid the mountains. As soon as they turned, the fire flared again, marching in patches up the hill, heading straight for the refuge in the birds. Anne was running up to the blackened, still-burning forest when her father texted her. "Anne, where are you? I can't fight this fire by myself." She hesitated, torn between the bird she had come to love like family and her father, the only family she had. More tankers roared overhead. "I'm coming." When Anne returned to her father's side, gray ash covered his face like a shroud, highlighting the shock in his blue-green eyes. The entire house was engulfed in a roaring cacophony of fire. A helicopter slinging a full bucket of water hovered into position over the house. A 1,000-gallon deluge dropped onto the house's remains. All the flames at the house died, leaving charred wood, twisted aluminum from window frames, and a concrete set of steps that led to nowhere. White steam rose from the debris. A puff of brown smoke escaped from the stovepipe. The wood stove was one of the few pieces of the house left over from the original building, which her father said was built a century ago, long before the development restrictions of the 2020s made the appliance illegal. The stove kept Anne and her father warm in the high country nights. Its blackened carapace chilled her. "Oh God! Oh God!" Bill clasped his hands to his head as if protecting it from the devastation. Anne had never seen him in a state of shock. Was this how he looked when Molly left us? They walked into the corpse of the house. Heat rose from the ashes. Grit choked the air. She searched for the woodcut, but found nothing. Not even the glass case. The only fragment she recognized was the cooked blob of her pistol marksmanship trophy. Bill lifted the metal picture frame, which still held a seared, soaked image of Anne's dark-haired, fair-skinned mother. He dropped the photo among the scorched fragments of two lives, mementos of his sailing days, melted plastic toys. And he keened as if his heart had been torn out. Anne wished the photo had burned. It had the opposite meaning of the woodcut. The photo sat on the shelf for her father's sake, not Anne's. A reminder of the abandonment, not love. All she remembered of her mother was her anger, which flared into rage in dreams or occasional argument with Bill. Her father sometimes fell into dark moods and glared at the photo. Why he kept it was a mystery to Anne as a child. Though, as she grew into a young woman and noticed the young men around her, something about her father's need for the photo became clearer. He was only lonely. And some of his memories of Molly were happy ones. Daughter wrapped her arms around her father, guiding him like a child, pulling him away from the carnage, ignoring the sweat and cake dust on his body, her own tears mixing with the dirt and water that saturated his shirt and jeans. Her sea tribe posted dozens of messages, trying to soothe her and tell her she wasn't alone and that the community would help. She heeded nothing aside from her father's grief, her own disbelief at the destruction of her life, and the cadaver of her home. It was the end of her world. The world around Anne kept going. Two fire trucks, one a red pumper from the local fire district, and the second a fire suppression unit from the State Department of Forestry, roared up the pitted dirt road that wound through the Penn Place's forested ravine. The pumper peeled off across the field to the front of the ruined house. A firefighter, his face streaked with sweat, dragged over a hose to soak the coals. He impressed Anne with his fearlessness. The suppression unit pulled up to rear near the equipment shed, its electric motor straining as it climbed the steep driveway. It drove to the blackened edge of the trees that bordered the refuge. Hydraulic levers lowered a squad of four-legged robots to the ground. Each robot had huge tanks on its back. They moved like enormous headless bulldogs. The machines climbed straight into the trees and up the hillside into the flames, as if they were fireproof goats. A whaling aid unit stopped on the dry grass that was once the Penn's yard. A McCall County Sheriff helicopter, the size of a wren, hovered 20 feet over Anne's head. A patrol car, lights blazing, kicked up dust as it parked next to the aid unit. A well-built man, wearing body armor and a pistol, trotted up to Anne and her father. "Are you and Ann all right, Bill?" the officer said. Ann's father was weary and red-eyed. "I can't say that I'm glad to see you, Gary. But was I ever glad to see you?" Ann's father shook as his adrenaline rocked his body. She was jittery herself. The EMT led them back to the aid unit. He draped each with a thermal blanket, despite the 95-degree temperatures.
"I don't remember a single time, Bill," said the officer. His name was Lieutenant Gary Schmidt.
He was responsible for the scattered farms and homesteads in this part of the valley. Schmidt was one of the few cops Ann trusted.
"I'm not going to ticket you this time, Bill. Even if you deserve it again for that wood stove."
Bill lowered his head into his hands, as if hiding the horror around him.
"Do you need anything, Bill?"
Ann's father shook his head. She clung to him in a way unlike any since her mother said goodbye. Ann's eyes, which her father said were the color of fertile loam, like her mother's, stared toward the remnants of the house. Neither she nor her father was physically hurt, and the fact of their mental loss did not feel real, despite the hollowness in her chest. Are the magpies gone too? She remembered the single nest, untouched as the fire tankers fought it. She raised her eyes to the refuge, and she watched another small remote control helicopter buzz over its smoldering remains.
Chapter 2. Deputy Inspector Janine Kylel tracked the surveillance drone out of the corner of her eye as it hovered over the blackened landscape of the refuge. She sat in the front seat of her forest green cruiser, its doors emblazoned with the shield of the Bureau of Environmental Security, going over intelligence reports on her highest priority case, an oil smuggling ring operating on the west coast of America. As the one available case officer in the region, she was sent to the fire scene when the BES monitoring stations picked up the emergency call. A screen showed the refuge from the drone's perspective, but Kyla's attention was on an analysis of the smugglers' conjectured routes. The pigeon-sized copter's AI maneuvered among the blackened pines and halted the aircraft at each stump of wheatgrass, sedge, wild sunflower, and yarrow. A tiny beep interrupted Kyla's focus, and the drone's camera shone an ash-covered corpse of a bird, its feathers burned off. Taking control of the camera, Kylel sought out a yellow band on the leg, but the bird appeared to be a juvenile, rather than an adult banded by the biologist who monitored the refuge. Kylel touched a key, instructing the copter to search for similar objects, and the aircraft found two more dead chicks. Kylel recalled the copter, and she opened up the local fire district database via her tablet. She found the preliminary report on the fire. It pinned the cause on the flying embers from the fire at the neighboring property, which belonged to a William Penn. There was a link from his name in the fire district's report to the county sheriff's database, and she read a summary of his case file. A driver's license photo showed a man in early middle age with short cropped hair, kind eyes, a Roman nose, and thin lips. She noted numerous carbon breaches, though the penalties were slaps on the Penn's wrist. Penn was an ongoing problem, and Kylel wondered if law enforcers in these parched Oregon counties would ever understand the seriousness of environmental crimes. "It doesn't matter. It's in my lap now." She pressed the accelerator, and the car's electric motor whispered. Kylel saw the mailbox at the gate to the Penn property before she made out the burned-out house, eddies of smoke rising from the ruins. The lights of the pumper truck and aid unit flashed as the firefighters and paramedics packed by. She edged the cruiser past the scene to the spot closer to the refuge. The state fire suppression unit was mopping up near the ridgeline. The inspector was tall, athletic, with bust and hips proportional. She wore office-style attire, standardized for the bureau. The comm stud in her ear was functional, without the decorative flourishes some women preferred. Her blonde hair was cut in a plain manner, and she wore little makeup. She didn't need it. Her father described her as pretty, but not girlish. She had a voice the color of fine dark bread, and lips as smooth as nectarine skin. She was a woman unafraid of her own power. Walking a quarter mile up a trail that wound through the desolation, she found the corpses of two adult birds, a type of magpie, near a dead chick in the remains of the nest. She bent down to the victims, resisting the urge to touch the evidence in the crime scene. Kylel grew heartsick as she imagined the adult birds, torn between escape and protecting their offspring, overwhelmed by the speed of the fire,
How many other times will this drama play out as the spike continues to devastate the natural world? All efforts to protect wildlife for future generations undone by the thoughtlessness of one person. She had joined the BES to defend nature and her planet against such people. The birds were dead, but the ID chips on the band still transmitted species, sex, banding date, and ID number. Kylel noted the codes as she tapped into the biologist's database. Only 29 nesting pairs remained in the world. Walking through the open graveyard, Kylel found 52 more dead adults. She guessed that all the chicks were dead, or soon would be. All the nesting pairs lived in this refuge. No signals broadcast for the remaining 4 known adults. She imagined them flying off in terror. It would be up to the biologist to find them in the follow-up investigation. Kylel tipped her head back and opened her eyes to the sky, where a pair of turkey vultures circled overhead. She offered a prayer for the deceased birds. The inspector returned to her car, and she drove into Penn's driveway. She recognized him from the driver's license photo. Next to him was a young woman whom Kylel deduced was his daughter Anne. Her arm was woven into her father's. A sheriff's patrol car obscured Kylel's view, but she watched them through the car's glass as if peering through layers of time. An unwelcome memory stirred. A grieving father at the bedside of a dying mother. Brushing memory from her mind, Kylel glanced in the rearview mirror, her mahogany-colored eyes seeking out the robot in its locker, which took up half of the rear compartment. A ready light glowed green. "Security, deploy." The robot left the car, and Kylel followed, smoothing out the dark green fabric of her BES uniform. The color matched the green paint of the car. A small gold tulip was pinned on the collar of her blouse, the color of malachite. Kylel approached Penn, the girl Anne, and the deputy, her robot a step behind her. The girl glanced back at the refuge, which was smoking like a vision of hell. "No, you can't take him," Anne shook her head, in denial of the facts she knew to be true. "It was an accident."
"William Penn?"
Kylel ignored the girl and addressed the man with a dirty face and stained t-shirt. Her voice was even and smooth. The sheriff's deputy stepped back.
"Yes?"
Penn's eyes widened with fear. Fear is good.
"My name is Kylel."
Her BES badge reflected the lights of the emergency vehicles. "I am an environmental crimes investigator. This was your house." Kylel saw his pulse jump, belied by the throbbing, corroded artery in his neck. If he ran, the security robot would hunt him and stop him. "I'm sorry for the loss of your house, Mr. Penn." Kylel's feelings were sincere. "A preliminary investigation of this incident has found that the burning of your structure led to the fire at the wildlife refuge."
"It was an accident." Anne's blonde hair hung limp against her face.
Penn broke in.
"I was cooking dinner. There was a spark."
"Before you say anything more," Kylel said, "I'd advise you that this conversation is being recorded, and your words and actions are evidence." Penn swallowed. "I must ask you to turn around and place your hands behind your back." He complied as if it were habit. Anne shouted and tried to push Kylel away, but the deputy restrained her.
"Anne," Penn said, "don't make it worse. You know the Bessies will, if they can."
Penn's face tensed with rage. Kylel ignored Penn's assessment and the Bessies' insult. She tightened the handcuffs around his wrists. "You are under arrest, Mr. Penn, for destroying the protected habitat of an endangered species, unauthorized killing of members of that species, and violations of the Carbon Acts."
Will Anne see her father again? What else lays ahead for this family in a future ravaged by climate change? Carbon Run is available on Amazon. Remember to leave a review for this and all of the stories you read. Reviews are such an important part of any artist's growth and are an easy, free way for you to support your favorite author, musician, or even podcast show. Did you get the hint there? Indie Beginning is funded by ACM Books, which in turn is funded by myself and Marie. If you have enjoyed this episode or all of our episodes, please leave a 5-star review wherever you have subscribed to the podcast. Marie and I would be so appreciative. On our next episode, we speak with J.G. Follinsby about why he chose climate change as the backdrop for his story, his research for the book, and the difficulty of using climate change as a topic.
being a podcast, you probably missed my air quotes. Somehow climate change is still a controversial topic. This episode was brought to you by Shirts by Sarah. Head over to shirtsbysarah.com and pick up a shirt that tells your tale. Indie Beginning is an ACM Books production. All readings in this episode were performed by myself, with the permission of the author. I am your host, Benjamin Franke, asking everyone to read more books, be the best possible you, and to simply enjoy this wonderful life. Thanks for listening.